this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We will remember and honor all of our ancestors in the struggle who went before us. We will speak truth to power as we have been doing since the first National Day of Mourning in 1970.
In 1970, the first National Day of Mourning took place at Plymouth Rock on what has been called Thanksgiving Day.
The founders of Chiquita were actually known as the Cecil Rhodes of Central America. In other words, they were the people who permitted practices, more subtle forms of feudalism or slavery.
A court in the United States has found multinational fruit company Chiquita Brands International liable for financing a Colombian paramilitary group. Chiquita, previously known as United Fruit, has been responsible for untold suffering of indigenous people and other groups in Central and South America.
In the case of settler colonialism, where they want the land itself and not just the labor, it's an elimination of the native.
And historian, author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz shares her insight on indigenous resistance during American expansion, Andrew Jackson, and forced removal. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste of KPFT in Houston. Indigenous people are not trying to ruin the holiday of so-called Thanksgiving and disrupt family celebrations. But the so-called first Thanksgiving was not so friendly. Wamsutta Frank James, a Wampanoag man, along with a group of supporters, met atop Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts on November 27, 1970, to commemorate the first National Day of Mourning. The United American Indians of New England declared it an annual tradition since 1970. Here's Wamsutta Frank James' granddaughter, Keisha James, speaking on the annual National Day of Mourning in 2023 at Coles Hill above Plymouth Rock in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Good afternoon, sisters, brothers, and siblings. Once again on so-called Thanksgiving Day, United American Indians of New England and our supporters are gathered on this hill to observe a national day of mourning for the indigenous people murdered by settler colonialism and imperialism from Turtle Island to Palestine. Today marks the 54th time we have gathered here to mourn our ancestors, tear down settler mythologies, and speak truth to power. National Day of Mourning came into existence 53 Thanksgivings ago when my grandfather, an Aquinnah Wampanoag man named Wamsutta Frank James, was invited by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to speak at a banquet celebrating the 350th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims. The organizers of the banquet no doubt imagined that Wamsutta would sing the praises of the American settler colonial project and thank the Pilgrims for bringing civilization to these shores. However, the speech that Wamsutta wrote, which was based on historical fact rather than the sham version of history perpetuated in the Thanksgiving myth, was a far cry from complimentary. In his speech, Wamsutta not only named atrocities committed by the Pilgrims, but he also reflected upon the fate of the Wampanoag at the hands of settler invaders. Wamsutta's speech contained a powerful message of Native American pride. "Our spirit refuses to die," wrote Wamsutta. "Yesterday we walked the woodland paths and sandy trails. Today we must walk the macadam highways and roads. We are uniting. We stand tall and proud, and before too many moons pass, we'll right the wrongs we have allowed to happen to us." When state officials saw an advance copy of Wamsutta's speech, they refused to allow him to deliver it, saying that the speech was too inflammatory. They told him he could speak only if he were willing to offer false praise of the pilgrims. The organizers even offered to write a speech for him, one which would better fit with their settler narrative. But Wamsutta refused to have words put into his mouth. His suppressed speech was printed in newspapers across the country, and he and other local native activists began to plan a protest. The flyer for this protest, which was circulated nationwide, read, "What do we have to be thankful for? The United American Indians of New England have declared Thanksgiving Day to be a national day of mourning for Native Americans." On so-called Thanksgiving Day, 1970, Wamsutta and members of at least 25 tribes, as well as a sprinkling of non-Native allies, gathered here on this hill and observed the first National Day of Mourning. Attendees spoke out about the Pilgrim invasion and conditions in Indian country, marched around Plymouth, boarded the Mayflower II, and even buried Plymouth Rock in sand. "We went to Plymouth for a purpose. To mourn since the landing of the pilgrims the repression of the American Indian, and to indict the hypocrisy of a system which glorifies that repression." The founders of National Day of Mourning could not have foreseen that generations would continue to gather here year after year, carrying on this tradition. Many of the elders who stood on this hill and organized the first National Day of Mourning are no longer with us, but we feel their spirits guiding us today. So, why do so many people, Native people, object to the Thanksgiving myth? According to this myth, the pilgrims, seeking religious freedom, landed on Plymouth Rock. The Indians welcomed them with open arms and then conveniently faded into the background, and everyone lived happily ever after. The end. Here is the truth. First, the pilgrims are glorified and mythologized because the circumstances of the first permanent English colony in North America, Jamestown, were too ugly to hold up as an effective national myth. Pilgrims and Indians are a much more marketable story than settler cannibalism. Second, the pilgrims came here as part of a commercial venture. They didn't need religious freedom. They already had that back in the Netherlands. The Mayflower Compact was merely a group of white men who wanted to ensure they would get a return on their investment. Third, when the pilgrims arrived, on Outer Cape Cod, by the way, not on that pebble down the hill, one of the first things they did was to rob Wampanoag graves at Corn Hill and steal as much of their winter provisions of corn and beans as they were able to carry. Fourth, some Wampanoag ancestors did greet the pilgrims and save them from starvation. And what did we, the indigenous people of this continent, get in return for this kindness? Genocide, the theft of our lands, the destruction of our traditional ways of life, slavery, starvation, and never-ending oppression. Fifth, the first official Thanksgiving did not take place in 1621, when the pilgrims had a harvest time meal provided largely by the Wampanoag. Instead, the first Thanksgiving was declared in 1637 by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony to celebrate the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children on the banks of the Mystic River in Connecticut. Subsequent slaughters of indigenous people would be celebrated by a day of Thanksgiving, and yet we are labeled as savages in the history books. So why does any of this matter? It is simple. When people perpetuate the myth of Thanksgiving, they are not only erasing our genocide, but also celebrating it. We did not simply fade into the background, as the Thanksgiving myth says. We have survived and flourished. We have persevered. The very fact that you are here is proof that we did not vanish. Our very presence on this land frees the land from the lies of the history books and the myth makers. We will remember and honor all of our ancestors in the struggle who went before us. We will speak truth to power as we have been doing since the first National Day of Mourning in 1970.
That was Keisha James speaking at the 2023 Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock. You can watch this year's Day of Mourning live stream from Plymouth beginning at 12 noon on November 28.
so that we can reconcile it. Put it in the past. They say that we can reconcile it. What if I can't? It's in my blood. It's in my blood. Oh, oh, oh. It's in my blood. Why does it feel like we're on the edge, staring down a certain day? Why does it feel like the story ends before it starts? We were here in these faded memories, so we were here. There's no reason we were here. And these disappearing words, even when they start losing meaning. It's in my blood. It's in my blood.
We Were Here by Asanabi, a beautiful introspective of memory, identity, and the passage of time. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Jacqueline Batiste. Immigration has dominated the U.S. election season, but what do people who are indigenous to the land have to say about who is illegal and who isn't? From Al Jazeera Plus, we hear some of those voices.
Personally, I cringe every time I hear the word illegal.
I don't think that people realize that the first illegal immigrants were European settlers.
We're still here and we care about what's going on.
With Indigenous people being left out of the immigration conversation, it makes me feel forgotten.
It almost makes us as a people still feel like we are non-existent.
If we're going to talk about illegal immigration, we need to go back in the last 350 to 500 years ago, of starting with Plymouth Rock and who had permission to come over to our lands.
I'd even feel uncomfortable saying an immigrant. My ancestors, you know, a long, long time ago didn't have those concepts.
It is very ironic and very frustrating that the people who are imposing their right-wing beliefs and their very, like, staunch, I guess, stance on immigration, calling, you know, our families illegal and trying to push these borders upon us, weren't the original people of this land anyway.
If we're going to talk about enforcing, you know, stricter regulations around the border and enforcing border patrol, then what does that mean for those reservations that are split and those tribes that are split by the border?
There are several Native people communities that live along the U.S.-Mexico border, and several of them, their lands are divided by the border, and that's my people too.
We don't think of the people who are south of the border who are coming up, you know, for a better life as indigenous people.
Just because time has continued to go on and these borders have been created and different policies to hinder some of that movement, it doesn't mean that the people innately are going to stop.
There's such things as sacred sites, as places of worship and places that are culturally and historically important for people that live along the U.S.-Mexico border.
These U.S.-imposed borders have a real physical effect on our families, on our way of life, on our traditions, on our culture, everything from gathering foods to practicing ceremonies.
I think that what is important for Indigenous voices is that we speak up and that we realize that we're not foreigners on our own land, regardless of what borders are there.
America doesn't belong to anybody. It's just a plot of land that all of us as human people, we're just here to be stewards of the land.
The land is our, it's our earth, it's our medicine. To us, it's our mother.
Thanks to Al Jazeera Plus for sharing with us.
I was listening to the voices of life chanting in unison, carry on the struggle. The generations surge together in resistance to meet the reality of power. Mother Earth embraces her children in natural beauty to last beyond oppressor's brutality. As the butterfly floats into life, we are the spirit of natural life, which is forever. The power of understanding, real connections to spirit, is meaning our resistance, our struggle, is not sacrifice lost. It is natural energy, properly used. One time, I was visiting with my relatives. The clouds, the mountains, the sky, the trees. My relatives touched my spirit, nudged it lovingly. Listen to us, impatient one. We are forever. You must remember the gentleness of time. You are struggling to be who you are. You say you want to learn the old ways. Struggling to learn when all you must do is remember. Remember the people. Remember sky and earth. Remember the people have always struggled to live in harmony, in peace.
That was John Trudell with Listening Honor Song. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batisse. The United Fruit Company, now Chiquita Brands International, is nicknamed El Pupo, Spanish for the octopus, because it formed a vast bloody empire stretching across Central and South American countries. Its blood-stained history involved the U.S.-backed coup in Guatemala, ushering in Guatemala's horrific history of human rights abuses and genocide against the indigenous Mayan people. Thousands of Colombians whose families were murdered by Chiquita-funded death squads have been seeking justice from the banana giant. On June 10, 2024, in a groundbreaking verdict, a U.S. court found Chiquita liable. Mimi Rosenberg, host of WBAI's Building Bridges radio show, spoke with Professor Terry Carl from the Earth Rights Team that has been working on this case since July 2007.
Well, Terry, what was the Chiquita case about, and what had to be done to prove in a court that these atrocities were actually occurring?
Well, first of all, a jury returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs, who were family members of workers and peasants who had been killed by a right-wing paramilitary, the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, the AUC, I'll call them from now on. It returned a verdict saying that the eight plaintiffs would receive an unprecedented $38.3 million because of Chiquita's complicity in what the AUC had done. Its complicity, the jury found, was in supporting paying the AUC, which subsequently was responsible for the atrocities that happened in the banana producing, not all the atrocities, by the way, but most of the atrocities in the banana producing regions of Santa Marta and Urubá. So the verdict was, first of all, that the AUC had caused the deaths of these plaintiffs, of the members of the named victims, excuse me, the plaintiffs and their families, and that Chiquita in turn had violated Colombian law by failing to act as a reasonable business person, and also by knowingly providing substantial assistance to a group, this is a terrorist group, knowing, being able to foresee that they would use this for assistance for atrocities and for the commission of atrocities. And finally, for providing a substantial assistance to this group, that meant it would then provide a more serious risk to others. That is what the case was about. I should add that Chiquita's version, or Chiquita's story in response to this, was the company was being extorted by the AUC and that they had to give this money in order to continue their business practices in the banana-producing regions of Colombia. They actually produced a memo calling the cost of doing business in Colombia, in which they said, this is the cost of doing business. The memo, by the way, did not claim extortion. It just said it was the cost of doing business.
Let's break it down a little bit more. The cost of doing business. We care that there is a friendly yellow banana image, a company in the U.S. that is paying dollars to death squads to kill its own workers. What actually happened? Let's really paint the gruesome picture that deserves to be painted against these peasant workers who are actually working for Chiquita.
Well, some of them are working for Chiquita. Some of them owned lands in the area and were forced off their lands by the violence of the AUC. Before I say that, let me just say this is a story of turning the tables, if I could put it that way. Chiquita is probably the very first multinational corporation in the United States. It's the first one that moved beyond U.S. borders to move into Latin America, in particular Central America, Colombia, Ecuador later. And it had a practice, actually, as in its old guise of United Fruit, of exporting labor practices and land practices from the United States that had already been deemed illegal, irresponsible, immoral, whatever language you want, and actually exporting those practices back to Central America outside the United States. So the founders of Chiquita were actually known as the Cecil Rhodes of Central America. In other words, they were the people who permitted practices like lynching, different forms of not overt, but more subtle forms of feudalism or slavery. That's what used to happen. And what the verdict represents is the statement that not only are we not going to export, or is it not permissible to export those kinds of practices, it's a verdict that actually used Colombian law to explain and show that what Chiquita did in Colombia was actually against Colombian law, not just U.S. law. And that kind of turning the tables, it's a Forbes called it a shot against the bow of multinationals, that they cannot anymore or should not anymore use practices in countries that are both illegal in those countries, but also generally illegal in ours. That's the big unprecedented story. And very important one, I think. Banana corporations can only operate in certain kinds of soils and climates. And that means there are certain places that they must operate. In Latin America, that's Colombia, which was really the first banana company when Panama was part of Colombia. It's also Central America and now Ecuador. So in operating in those areas, there what a multinational needs is a matter of debate. Some multinationals believe that they don't need to own the land. They don't need to control the land. They just need to control the production of bananas, the labor that produces bananas. Others, in this case it would be Chiquita, went from saying we can just work with domestic Colombian producers and let them deal with their labor any way they want. But what they did, which is what they decided in 1984, what they did in 1988, they reversed course and said, now we're going to move in and become the largest landowner in the banana producing regions, which means that the labor problem is no longer mediated by domestic producers. It's what they call the labor problem. The labor that they use is no longer mediated by domestic producers, but is now going to be mediated by Chiquita.
That was Professor Terry Carl speaking to Mimi Rosenberg, host of Building Bridges from Pacifica's WBAI in New York. On October 18, 2024, a U.S. court upheld the landmark jury verdict against Chiquita and rejected Chiquita's motion to reduce the jury award. United Fruit used their repressive tactics against vibrant social movements, labor, and indigenous peoples, such as the Garifuna people of Honduras. Eduardo Galeano, author of The Open Veins of Latin America, called this relationship a broken system brought upon by foreign invaders and their economic promiscuity.
Daylight come and me won't go home. Work all night and I drink a rum.
Daylight come and me won't go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me won't go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me won't.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Day is a day. A beautiful bunch, a ripe banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Hide the deadly black tarantula.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Daylight
come and me one go home.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
That was Harry Belafonte and the Banana Boat Song. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste. WPFW, our sister Pacifica station in Washington, D.C., honored Indigenous Peoples Day last month with all-day special Indigenous programming, calling it Unpacking Indigeneity. Thanks to them for honoring Indigenous Peoples Day. Here is an interview from Unpacking Indigeneity with historian writer Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, which aired on the Africa Now program with Tasmini Siddiqui. about Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment.
Loaded is a timely and significant text on the history of gun culture and how it reflects race, gender, and power in the United States. Your book peels back the myths around the Second Amendment's right to bear arms and exposes the connections between arming the earliest Anglo settlers, modern-day policing, and the persistence of white supremacy as a political force.
The commodification that came along with capitalist settler colonialism is sort of distinctive among, you know, in other colonial experiences, which are horrible and they're all genocidal. But specifically in settler colonialism, there's the, you know, there's the hope that the people will just go away, you know, so they can take the land for production and people it with imported people from, you know, from the mother country, but also imported enslaved Africans. So this took root mainly in North America and in New Zealand and Australia, early British colonialism. Later they turned to, in Africa and India and other places, to indirect colonialism, that is working through local, like the Raj in India. That in those cases, they use the native people as labor, not necessarily enslaved, but bonded labor, like in South Asia or in Africa even, just enslaving the peasantry to work or bonding them. They don't even have to enslave them necessarily if they're there. But in the case of settler colonialism, where they want the land itself and not just the labor, it's an elimination of the native. So this is, you know, really intentionally genocidal, and many methods of doing it, but mainly the kind of warfare that's counterinsurgent warfare that attacks civilians rather than any fighting forces in their villages, burning the crops, burning food storage, driving them out into the peripheries as refugees. And this then is like a 400-year project in North America. It took 400 years to take the whole continent. And in between there, at one point, the United States became independent and didn't really miss a beat of implementing even more without any kind of regulations from a mother country, implementing the same kind of settler colonialism and genocide. The other side of that is, of course, the importation of enslaved Africans, the transporting, and this went on till the international slave trade was outlawed by Britain and then others. It still continued, but, you know, fewer, more expensive and fewer, and it was illegal. But slavery was still legal. Slavery in Britain, slavery everywhere was still legal, just not the transatlantic slave trade. Thanks to, you know, the British Anti-Slavery Society and Africans themselves have resisting enough to, you know, that the moral consciousness is affected. But in the United States, they were very unhappy about that, but just set about using the South Carolina and Virginia colonies as really slave production colonies, reproduction. And there's so many aspects of gender violence that intersect with all of this, particularly that using African women as already, you know, born in the United States, enslaved African women, as reproduction machines, you know, for the Cotton Kingdom to supply. So this really hideous practice went on, you know, up until the Civil War, so like 70 years. And then the brutality, super brutality, you might say, of the Cotton Kingdom enslavement, where there was no longer, say, any possibility for having a family, because it was purely a commercial venture, and the bodies, the very bodies of enslaved Africans were a commodity, the total of which, this is extraordinary. These are some studies that have come out only in the last years. The information was always there, but no historians have really wanted to see the extent of it and admit it. But Ed Baptiste and Walter Johnson and some other historians did that research, and they found that the total value of the capital that the enslaved bodies, the ownership of this, the property and African bodies, was greater than all other assets of the United States put together, including all gold and storage, all investments, all land, all the real estate, land, everything. So I think unless we understand that, we don't understand the nature of capitalism as it has developed, because it did develop, you know, most successfully, if you can use that word, in the United States, which, you know, came to dominate the world economy, military, and everything else. The connection of that with gun violence, which is the subject of Loaded, you can't understand the gun violence or the gun proliferation or the meaning of guns to U.S. Americans without it being in that context, because it's completely out of bounds. You know, it's does not compare to any place else, even, you know, in war zones. I think there's a demographic can be identified along with the white nationalism and racism is descendant, you know, comes out of actual U.S. history, and even, you know, as I showed in the Second Amendment, but also deeply in the Constitution itself, actually allows this to continue at some level, you know, of suppression of knowledge, but also simply keeping the descendants of those people in a secondary position, and of course enriching a very small upper class. But you have a populist democracy where every white man, by the Second Amendment, every white man had the right to kill Indians and chase down any fugitive slaves.
But I wanted to go back and look at these relationships and these histories of indigenous and Africana and African descended communities in the Americas, particularly around, like, we have these examples of the Seminoles, Maroon communities as well. Can you lay some of that relationship, those alliances, out for us?
Well, it's so important. You probably remember being, you know, the literature coming out in the 60s and 70s, the Genovese and Aptekar debates over whether or not, I mean, the consensus was of liberal historians, it wasn't because something about enslaved Africans in the United States were not as unhappy as others, but because of this tight capitalist system of control and the cutting off of any contiguous borders, you know, like Texas, like Spanish Florida, Mexican Texas, where Marooners could go and fight from, that they didn't resist except in small ways, or, you know, now and then escaping, or the Frederick Douglass story, you know, just so few people then showing every uprising, slave revolt, as a total defeat, the Denmark Vesey or the Nat Turner. And again, not, this is something Native people have, and I think African Americans have this memory of these uprisings, not whether or not they were successful, but the fact that they happened. That means that's something to celebrate and be proud of and honor. But this idea that it was a closed system. But what's left out is that Native resistance itself, east of the Mississippi, is almost always completely ignored. You know, you do colonial history, basically up until the Mass Removal, the Indian Removal Act of 1830 and the mass removal that was more or less complete by 1850, there were constant resistance going on. It wasn't like army to army. You know, Native people didn't have armies. They were all guerrilla activities, you know, civilians. You know, they also tried to make Indians very warlike, and this was maybe a tiny bit of it. So for the Plains, the mounted Native people of the Plains, the Lakota, the ones in the Hollywood films. But in the East, it was, you know, guerrilla warfare, women involved. I mean, whole communities just as, you know, resisting. Native people don't use that term marooning, but that's exactly what they were doing in Florida, you know, is marooning. It's what they were doing in the dismal swamp, you know, of South Carolina, North Carolina, that area. They were marooning, and they built institutions all along the former Mexican border that had gone into when Mexico became independent. There were marooners all over there. So they were constantly then making forays into, you know, retaking their land and also building institutions that would allow others to escape and come in, you know, and be free. So the Seminole Nation was founded in Florida as an entity. I mean, there was Seminole people that existed. There were Muscogee people related to the Creeks who were very strongly resisted. Also the Shawnee up in the Ohio country, as they resisted as the United States got formed and came in. So when they were, yes, defeated, you could say, when they were overcome, they migrated to where the resistance was taking place. So basically they all ended up in Spanish Florida resisting. So it was many, many nations made up the Seminole Nation. The common language they used was the Muscogee language. That was the language of the Seminoles and the Creeks. But that the Shawnee and the Wyandotte and, you know, all the other people who came. And the Africans, there were almost an equal number of self-freed, liberated, so-called fugitive, enslaved Africans in that population as there were Native people. They built whole villages. They were kind of in the northern part of Florida. And then Andrew Jackson, you know, there's three wars against these people, three declared wars against the Seminole Nation from 1815 to 1858. Three different wars tried to get them out of there. Andrew Jackson led the first one, you know, the first war to, you know, get the Seminoles out, and it was still under Spanish control, and that what they basically did was overthrow the Spanish and annex Florida. And so when they did that, the marooners, you know, the Seminole Nation with the fugitive slaves, you know, it was always a multicultural nation. There were a lot of poor white farmers from Georgia also who joined them. It was a major long-term resistance, and they moved into the Everglades, and that's where they were able to survive and still exist to this day, you know, never made a treaty with the United States. But this resistance never appears as a multiracial, multinational resistance, and I don't think it really appears in African-American history as slave rebellion. But I think it's one of the most important and long-term, endless, you know. I mean, it just went on and on and on until the Civil War, the last Seminole Wars, was 1858. Well, after the end of slavery, that was the main reason. Actually, the U.S. government, Andrew Jackson, offered, once he became president, that they could, that the Indians, you know, they were understanding there were all kinds of different Native people there, but that the Seminole Indians could take the Everglades, have it as their own, if they would turn over all of the Africans among them to be restored to their, you know, put back on the slave market, because many of them had been born there, you know, I mean, they were generations. And they said no. This was Osceola, you know, that was a great leader who actually was from North Carolina, a native person from North Carolina, who went down to join. But there's also the Tuscarora resistance in North Carolina, that in the Dismal Swamp. So the native resistance and the slave resistance really were inseparable in that whole period of time.
That was historian and author Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz speaking to Tasmin Siddiqui, host of Africa Now on Pacifica's WPFW.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. In jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men. The tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me. They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life, it jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
That was I Pity the Country, a timeless anthem from 1971 by Willie Dunn, who is Mi'kmaq and Scottish and Irish. We're also remembering Leonard Peltier right now, convicted in a kangaroo court and is serving out a life sentence at this time. This is Robbie Robertson's song honoring Leonard called Sacrifice from 1998. Featuring Leonard Peltier.
You know, we have a million stories to tell. I'm just one of a million or more stories that could be told.
Your freedom. your prayer. Take away your language. Cut off all your hair. Sacrifice the loved ones who always stood by me. Stranded in the wasteland. Set my spirit free.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I am a Lakota and Anishinaabe. And I'm living in the United States Penitentiary, which is the swiftest growing Indian reservations in the country. I've been in prison since 1976 for an incident that took place on the Ogallala Lakota Nation. There was a shootout between members of the American Indian Movement and the FBI and the local sheriffs, state troopers. Two agents were killed and one Indian was murdered.
Robbie Robertson, Sacrifice, from 1998, featuring Leonard Peltier. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by me, Jacqueline Batiste, and co-produced by Akua Holt and Capitalism, Race, and Democracy's Collective. Our engineer is Paulina Vasiliev. Special thanks to Mimi Rosenberg and Tasmin Siddiqui. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Jacqueline Batiste. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. I think we live in an industrial dimensional reality where we're programmed to believe
what we're told.
We are told to believe what the ruling class wants us to believe. That was a quote from John Trudell, poet, writer, and activist.